Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming till you wake up on your own. Wonder where you are, and live with all your faults. I wanna wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all, so why don't you smile?
Joining me on this Tuesday morning is Alex Hollings, and we were talking off the air a few minutes ago. Alex is the new recipient of a broken leg, and one would expect nothing. But actually, the story's a bit of a disappointment, I have to tell you. I thought there was going to be a lot more to it. So can you explain to everybody how you broke your leg?
Yeah, so... a couple of weeks ago, I was talking to a buddy of mine from college, a guy I used to play rugby with, and we were talking about how as we've gotten older, we both just kind of spend more time in the workshop than we used to, just fiddling with things. And he said he's building birdhouses lately, and I was like, oh man, you know, my daughter and my wife have a garden, and they put a couple birdhouses up, and like they really love bird watching. You know, let me buy one of those birdhouses from you. So he built one for my kid and sent it to me, and when it arrived, I was so excited at the prospect of a new birdhouse that I took off down the stairs and lost my footing and managed to just go down pretty hard. And but I knew right away that I'd broken my leg. Obviously, I've broken my leg before. I've broken plenty of stuff before.
Wow.
So for me, it was – you know, it wasn't scary. It hurt, obviously, but it was – I was totally calm about it, and my daughter handled it really, really well. But my wife totally just didn't believe me. Because I was like, Reagan, I need you to go get your mom. Dad's got a bad boo-boo. And so she went and grabbed Jamie, and I'm pretty sure my wife, just because of the way Reagan was acting, didn't think it was that serious. And when she got there, I was just like, hey, you know, I fell down the stairs. I need you to take me to the emergency room. I don't want you guys to come in. Just drop me off. I'll be fine. And Jamie was like, I mean, don't you think we should just like call the doctor? You know, like we can make you an appointment. I was like, no, I definitely broke my leg. I just need you to drop me off. And they took good care of me, though. The hospital here in Cumming, they said that they're not overrun with COVID-19 patients, which is always good news, right?
Right.
And they had me in a little bubble in the hallway because there were a lot of patients, so there weren't enough rooms. You know, so I had to wear the mask and the gown and all that stuff to make sure that I, in all my wisdom, managed to break my leg in the middle of a pandemic so that I could go sit at the hospital with sick people. But so far, so good. I don't see.
Well, I mean, and that had to be a little bit concerning as well, because hospitals, you know, as much as they try not to be, you know,
hospitals are where you go to get sick, man. I firmly believe that. you know, both my parents, you know, my father's passed now, but prior to that, both my parents worked in healthcare my whole life, you know, and between them working in healthcare and, you know, three boys in school, my house was just like a viral, you know, round robin. We would just get each other sick. But like my mom will even tell you, if you can avoid going to the hospital, don't go to the hospital. Like, and but, you know, I fortunately it's I broke the fibula, not the tibia. So in your lower leg, the tibia is kind of the big meaty bone. And the fibula is the smaller one, and I broke the smaller one. And I think I must have broken it pretty low, close to the ankle, because that's where I felt it. And but of course, you know, I broke my leg over a holiday weekend or just prior to one. So
nice.
I haven't seen the specialist. I'm going tomorrow. And they said that I may need surgery, but I feel pretty confident that I won't. My leg feels pretty good. I think that it'll just be a cast or something. I tell you what, though, it has definitely made I have bragged forever about how short my commute is. It's just two flights of stairs to my office. And the commute's feeling pretty long.
And you even screwed that up. The last time I went to the emergency room, we had I want to say we ate steak, And I was living in North Dakota at the time. And I had put the my plate that I'd eaten, I'd put it on the couch. It was like a love seat kind of thing. Yeah. So I'd put it next to me, and then I must have been tired. I kind of laid down, and so the plate wound up behind my calves. Okay. As I kind of sat, laid side.
Yeah, as you kind of half laid right there, right?
So I then moved. No. This was actually the full couch. I take that back. There was the love seat was on the other wall. So I laid down on the full couch, and then I forgot the plate was there. I pull my calves kind of back towards the back of the couch to curl my legs. And I hit the steak knife perfectly against the back of my calf.
Oh my God.
With the point, and then pinned it to the back of the couch and inserted it. I don't know what it hit. It felt like it hit the bone, but probably not. Whatever it hit, oh my God. I rocket straight up and I grabbed the back of my calf. Our youngest might be, let's see, Colleen 16 now. I mean, she had to be, you know, 6 or 7, maybe.
That's like serendipitously bad luck to be able to nail.
You can do it. If I said, okay, here's what I want you to do, Alex. We're going to film a scene, but I need you to be able to, with the steak knife, pin it to your calf and then to the back of the couch. You'd be there like for 9 days trying to do it.
Right?
Right. And so I pulled a steak knife out of my calf, and I have my hands on my calf because it's bleeding, and like you though, knowing my kids, my daughter, my youngest daughter's there, I just look at my son and I said, "Hey, could you go get me a towel?" And he looks at me and goes, "All right." So he goes in and gets me a towel, and I take my hand out to put the towel, and there's blood everywhere now, and I looked at my ex-wife and I said, "I think we should go to the hospital." She's like, "All right."
So, fortunately for you, you were close by, as in it.
I was like how many blocks from the hospital? I wasn't very far from the hospital. Maybe 5 blocks from the hospital. So we go to the hospital, and the people in there know me. I'm on the city council. I do a radio show in town, and they're like, "Mac." I'm like, "Hi." They're like, "What are you doing here?" I said, "I kind of accidentally stuck a steak knife in my calf." But my daughter, when we get into, so, you know, my ex is, she's like laughing. I'm like, "This is ridiculous." I said, "I know, this is stupid. Now we're going to be here for hours." So we're in the waiting room.
That's exactly the same way I felt when I was like, "This was stupid, and now I'm going to be here for hours."
So we go in the, we go in the emergency room, and the doctor looks at it and he said, "Are you in any discomfort?" And I said, you mean my spirit or my body?" And he said, "Your body." And I said, "No." And he said, but my youngest looks at my ex and says, "Is daddy going to die?" Right.
Oh God.
I mean, because you're right. You know, if COVID wasn't there, you know, you didn't have time to drop your kid off. You'd take your kid to the emergency room and your kid sees all this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you know, my ex looks and says, "No, he's going to be fine. They're going to give him some stitches and he's going to be fine." And so, but you know, so I mean, for little kids, I mean, depending on how your parent reacts, I mean, again, my earliest memory in my life is of John Kennedy's funeral. And the reason I remember it isn't because of his funeral. It's because it was the first time I saw my mother cry. And I knew something. I didn't know what was wrong, but I knew something was really wrong because I'd never seen my mother cry. And now my mom's crying. So, the things that you remember as a kid.
I totally agree. So this was Reagan's second – fortunately, this time she didn't have to come in. But this was her second trip to the emergency room with Dad in her short 2.5-year life. But the last time I was alone with her, my wife you know, about a year ago, started going to therapy. And it had been like a while for her to build up to having the confidence to set the appointment and to go in and actually introduce herself to someone and to start talking to somebody. And of course, like 15 minutes after my wife left, for this thing that was tough for her to kind of overcome that hump to go and do, I tore my hand apart so bad that I had to go to the emergency room. Well, I was alone with my daughter, and so the last thing I wanted to do was call my wife and say, hey, you know, I know it's taken you months to get to this point, but I need you to reschedule and come back and get me and take me to the emergency room. So what I was running a website called The Loadout Room at the time, and we did gear reviews, and I was doing a review on one of those, you know, multi-purpose survival tools, which I will readily say now are stupid. But when people, you know, when they're your advertising partners, you try to find a good reason why it's worthwhile.
Yes.
And so one of the tools in this multi-tool was a big, very sharp arrowhead. And the idea was that you could use a stick to make it into a spear or even an arrow using this arrowhead. And so, you know, I'm trying the different functions of the thing out for a video I'm making for the site with Reagan playing outside in the woods, you know, near my house. And I think that a lesson I learned here that I should have known anyway is that if you're holding something very sharp and you have a toddler around, you can only pay enough attention to one or the other to stop something terrible from happening. And I was paying attention to the kid instead of the sharp object. And as I was trying to push a stick onto the base of the arrowhead to make it into a spear, the arrowhead just kind of turned on the log that I was using and just cut right through my finger. It ended up being 17 stitches, which on a finger is pretty good. I kind of cut my finger.
That's not a trivial matter.
So I immediately, you know, I didn't realize how bad the cut was initially. I knew it was a really bad cut, you know, bleeding a lot. So I took my t-shirt off and wrapped it around my hand and was like, hey, Reagan, you know, we need to go inside because daddy got a boo-boo. And she did. I was very proud of how she handled it. She didn't freak out, didn't panic, got very calm and was like, okay, followed me into the house. And then we got to the kitchen. I pulled apart my IFAC that I had in the kitchen and tried to rinse it. When I went to rinse it, I realized how bad.
Tell everybody what an IFAC is.
Oh, an IFAC is an individual first aid kit. It's a lot of times you'll have kind of emergency first aid stuff in it. I've got a couple IFACs around the house.
Yeah, and just so you Vietnam –
because I'm an idiot.
Yeah, just so you Vietnam-era dudes understand, we're not talking about the little green first aid kit that I got issued when I first came into Marine Corps. These things are the size.
Yeah. I mean, you've got trauma gauze. You've got chest seals. You've got tourniquets. I didn't need any of that stuff, obviously. I did need gauze. But so, you know, I tried to rinse it, realized that my finger was a lot worse than I thought because when I rinsed it, the skin, you know, separated and moved around. So then I tried to wrap it. It was bleeding too much to wrap. And my daughter just sat on the floor hugging my calf. Very calm, clearly concerned. And but, you know, I kept talking to her and I was like, oh, this is okay. You know, even if daddy's got a real bad boo-boo, it's still just his finger. And, you know, so I called my mom, who lives about an hour away and is she's a nurse. She's an infection control nurse now, but she spent a lot of time in the emergency room. And I was like, hey, mom, you know, I think I really did a number on my finger. And do you think you can come by and watch Reagan? And she was like, well, I'm an hour and a half away. You know, can you wait that long? And I was like, I don't think I should. So with one hand wrapped in a T-shirt and then with emergency gauze and then a T-shirt around it, I stuck the car seat in our spare car. That's a crappy old Honda CR-V. Drove my kid to the emergency room. This was obviously pre-coronavirus. And my kid sat right there in the emergency room. She watched them stitch me up, you know. And I think it was good for her to see that I was okay, so it wasn't scary, you know. Lord knows dad's gotten plenty of stitches. But she handled it so remarkably well. And I pride myself on being pretty good in a bad situation. And I don't know if maybe she just takes that from me or if it's because I was calm throughout.
Well, I think part of it is learned. I mean, I do that with, you know, because like when you screw your body up or something and your kids are standing there, I mean.
You got to keep your shit together. You know,
and it's not like it were like not. It's not like it's a that odd of an occurrence when you've done
yeah,
it.
Also true,
right? And you look at it, and right, and your kids are like, "Oh my god!" And you just look, and you're like, "Now I'm about to finish this piece of wood thing that I've been working on, right? And now I'm going to deal with this. And then, you know, and then so you'd be like, fuck it. And you go bandage it, right? And then you put like a decent sized bandage and you tape your hand. And then you go and you look at them like, come on, let's go finish. And they're like, what? Like, yeah, we're going to go finish. But what are we going to do? Stop? Like, what?
Right, but it's only half done. We're going to leave it there.
What about your hand? Don't worry about that. It'll still be there. Trust me. But, and so, I mean, that communicates, you know, when you get off your, when you fall off your bike, you know, you look at them and they're, you're like, okay, stop crying. Let me see your hands. And they put their hands up and they're skinned and you spit at them. And then you rub it together and you're like, do I feel better? And they're like, yes. All right. And you do the same thing with your knees. All right, let's get on the bike. Let's do this. You can do it. You almost had it that time. And then,
exactly.
And what I think, so to me, the reaction is what they learn from you. And if you panic and scream, that's what you're going to raise. And it's slowly but surely over time, you know, you're moving their cheese about what do you do when something goes wrong in your life, whether it's falling off your bike, whether it's slicing most of your finger off or something else. And I think it's absolutely a learned behavior.
I think that's 100% true. And honestly, I think you can usually tell from me how serious an injury is. The less serious it is, the more I'm going to bitch about it. So like I broke my leg last week. Every once in a while I'm just like, ah, man, you know, this thing aches. But if I stub my toe, I'm gonna hoot and holler and yell.
Oh, that hurts! There's no pain like stabbed into the calf to the bone is nothing compared with the completely unaware stubbing of a toe that puts you on the ground and has you howling.
I would much rather you surprise me with a punch to the face than a bad stubbed toe.
I know. Hey, I want you to explain something to us. I want you to explain cancel culture to us because you're a media person.
I am a media person and I'm an elder millennial.
You're an elder millennial. So what is cancel culture?
So I guess in order to talk about this, I'm going to have to admit that I've got a lot of internal bias, right? Okay. And so I can tell you what cancel culture kind of is from my perspective. I suppose somebody who didn't see it as such a negative thing might have a different explanation for it. But in my opinion, a cancel culture is sort of what we've seen develop on social media as the way in which we interact with one another. We as a society have gotten pretty addicted to outrage, but I would contend that our addiction isn't just to outrage. Our addiction is to feeling self-righteous, right? And so when somebody out there does something or says something that collectively, you know, a good portion, it doesn't need to be the majority, but it just needs to be a bunch, you know, a good portion of people all feel as though what that person did or said was awful. And so what people will do is it starts, I would argue, maybe honestly enough with people saying, shining a light on it and saying, hey, look at this awful thing someone said or someone did. And then everybody kind of hog piles on. And before you know it, the second and third order effects of you being canceled on social media manifest very real in very real ways in your real life.
So what is – so when you say canceled, you're using that as a verb.
Yes.
You mean right. you mean accounts closed and or do you just mean
– It's very much like let's say for instance and I'll readily admit that I've done or said things throughout my life as a Marine, as a football player, as an idiot, as a teenage boy that I'm sure people would be offended by. And you know, and if and when someone ever throws it in my face, the best I'll be able to do is say, yeah, man, I was an idiot when I was 17.
Right.
You know, however – when enough people kind of get motivated behind being angry at a person for something and they cancel them, quote unquote, what it really is it's a massive – there's a more negative connotation to this than maybe appropriate, but smear campaign, right? And so a good example that I could use might be James Gunn. James Gunn's a director who directed the Guardians of the Galaxy, the first two Guardians of the Galaxy movies, a number of other movies that he's done that have done well. But after Guardians of the Galaxy 2 came out and when they were entering pre-production for Guardians of the Galaxy 3, some tweets that James Gunn posted in like 2012, I want to say, it could have been a different year, some time ago, resurfaced. And those tweets were entirely insensitive and douchebaggy. You know, he said a bunch of really awful things. because at the time he thought that they were funny, you know. And I'm not defending what James Gunn said. I couldn't even give you the real exact specifics of what James Gunn said back then because I wasn't that interested. But as a result of people being really angry on social media, it started by people shining a light on these old posts. And then that quickly kind of snowballed into trying to hurt him personally or professionally in any way that we can. Now, I'm not saying that that's always the worst thing in the world, but I would contend that more often than not, mob justice isn't good justice. So, you know, a bunch of things cascaded. Disney fired James Gunn from Marvel, which he, you know, because there was a lot of people saying that was the wrong choice, he was able to find other work. As a result of just this one canceled guy, the whole Marvel Cinematic Universe schedule had to change for the next 10 years. There's plenty of other examples of people either rightly or maybe not so justifiably being canceled. Mel Gibson's an early one where, you know, a bunch of footage and recordings of him saying awful things kind of made it to the surface, and he was, quote, canceled in that people didn't want to buy his work. People didn't want to get him involved in their projects anymore. You know, you're effectively a pariah. Right. Now, in some cases, that may well be entirely justified. Right. The reason why I think cancel culture is so bad for us, though, is because I think that we're more interested in that feeling we get from being able to squash someone else than we are in necessarily making anything better. I find it very troubling, this idea that you can't be president if you said something dumb 30 years prior, or the idea that you can't, you know, be the CEO of a company if you were ever involved in something that was dumb and embarrassing in your 20s. A good example I can say of that is that recently Domino's popped up as Domino's is canceled as a trending hashtag on Twitter. And when you dug into why is Domino's canceled, it's because someone who now has a prominent, some would say white nationalist voice on Twitter, 10 years ago, that same person on the same Twitter profile who wasn't famous tweeted at Domino's, you know, we just got our new Domino's pizza and it's awesome. It's the bomb, something like that. And Domino's responded, hey, thanks. 10 years later, that person became a prominent white nationalist. And so now people want to cancel Domino's because 10 years before that, they thanked them for saying their pizza was good on Twitter.
That's a pretty long, stringy link to something.
Wouldn't you say? Hello? You know, don't you think that – now, I want to be clear here.
Well, I mean, but it is illustrative, Alex, of – I mean, you used the word mob that I think most people in this country – that are watching the news are watching what's going on in our country and going, wait a minute. And is it, I mean, they're filled with the sentiment, look, everybody makes mistakes. Shouldn't you be able to, you know, we used to get taught accept responsibility, right, and make it right.
And that's honestly firmly how I still feel.
If you're interested in making it better, but if you're only interested in vindictiveness, right, and destroying somebody, and to me, that's what I mean. That's why this stuff is so scary, in my opinion. I mean,
I think you're really nailing something on the head. Where nobody's trying to heal anything; everyone's just trying to hurt others. You know, and like a great example, I would contend that this extends.
Well,
into
I think
political.
You said it. I thought you said it better, actually, when you said about making it better. If you're interested in making it better, everybody gets a second chance. Everybody can screw it up, right? And it doesn't matter that you made a mistake. It matters what you do about your mistakes. That's the way we get raised. I think that's been a huge part of our culture.
I mean, that's how we grow
but
as
no,
individuals
but
and as
no
a group.
More, no more. If you don't do the things that you're supposed to do. In fact, I'll give you a headline from ESPN over the weekend. 6 Formula One drivers did not kneel is the headline. Not that, you know, 16 did kneel, that 6 did not kneel. That was the headline. And I saw that. I was like, wow. So now if you aren't on board with this, you're the headline. We're going to hold you up until you're beaten into submission for – and again, I don't care what the point is, right? You know, and that's the kind of mob and the media lends to it. And so,
well, you know, it's funny that you say you don't care what the point is, because I agree. Any time that you are socially obligated to participate, then you have completely removed any value from what you are doing. And I would contend it works whether you're talking about patriotism or the opposite of patriotism. It works whether we're talking about kneeling before a sporting event or not kneeling. It works if we're talking about just you being the person that – we saw it with every business ever in the United States, has issued a statement in recent weeks regarding Black Lives Matter. And I genuinely have no qualms whatsoever with a company doing that, because they're saying, are the values that we maintain as a company, as an organization, as a group of people, are represented in this movement. I genuinely don't have any qualms with it. I do have an issue with it when you do it because the news story is which ones didn't.
To make your point, what I have a problem with is you have companies like Apple, Google, Facebook, who want to lecture the world about race, but if you look at their executive levels, they're not anywhere close to the demographics of the nation. Nowhere close. They are lily white at their executive level. And so it's like, okay, look, I think Dr. King's dream, right, was that the American dream be open for everybody. You guys can hire anybody you want to, and you just don't listen to your HR people when it comes to, when it comes to the demographics of your business, And so to me, that it's like my head wants to explode. It's like, wait a minute, you're going to lecture somebody else? First of all, why don't you shut the fuck up? Why don't you live it before you lecture it? And live it at your executive level. So people, and you can go out and hire anybody from any Ivy League schools. You have that kind of business. You have that kind of cash. You can do anything you want to. And you don't do it. You choose not to do that. Amazon is the worst. They were like out of 110 executive positions, they had like one black person. And then,
my computer's yelling at you.
Oh, that's all right. So, I mean, to me, that's another part of this is companies that, and then the other part of the whole Black Lives Matter, that if you say, I do believe that Black Lives Matter, but I do believe that all lives matter, that will get you canceled. That will get you fired now. And so the discussion, that's why to me this, that's why I wanted to ask you as a fringe millennial, about the whole cancel culture, because the intolerance, the destruction, and if you look at mobs in history, whether it be in the French Revolution or the way mobs behave, at some point it comes to eat you that have stood by and said, well, they're not getting me today, so that's okay. I know it's wrong, but I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to push back on this thing. At some time it comes for you, and then it eats itself. And
I think that there's two really important things you touched on there. And the first one is, we're talking about these organizations kind of lecturing people from what I could call, in all honesty, artificial positions of authority, right? And I want to quote so at Sandbox, there's a man named Herrick Ross that works with us. He's a retired gunnery sergeant. He's a really bright, brilliant dude who also happens to work in diversity and inclusion is one of the things that he works on. He's an MBA and a bunch of other stuff too. But one of the things that he works on is diversity and inclusion. And he said something that really resonated with me recently when he said that if you want to act like race and inclusion matters, then you've got to do one of two things. You either have to have a person at the table when you're making big and important company-wide meetings, executive level leadership, that is cognizant of, is aware of, lives kind of the challenges that we're trying to address with diversity and inclusion. So you either have to have someone at the table, or it needs to be put on the menu in every discussion, right? So if you're going to approach something like this honestly and sincerely, and I don't mean you're going to issue a statement that sounds honest and sincere. I mean, if you actually want to address this issue, if you really want to work on this issue, and Herrick, admittedly, I have to say Herrick is helping us work on this issue at Sandbox. But if you want to work on this issue, there has to be somebody at the table, or there has to be something in the syllabus for your conversation for it to mean anything. Otherwise, it's a platitude. Otherwise, you're just saying we support blankety blankety cause for popularity's sake. And you don't change
and
your
hopefully they don't look at our numbers and throw our shit in the street. Okay.
Exactly.
Hopefully.
Now,
other
thing I wanted to touch on that I think that you said that was really, really important is when we're talking about issues like this, like in the United States, race is obviously an issue, right?
Right.
People manifest that issue in different ways. You know,
Alex, let me just tell you, I'm much older than you. Right. If you were living in Georgia when I was a kid and you could,
it would have been much different.
And you
certainly
could see what the United States is today, you would say, look, are there people that are racist in this country? Yes, without a doubt. Are we where we need to be when you look at corporate hiring? No, there's work to be done. However, the difference in this country, you know, the fastest growing, you know, category demographically in the census is mixed race couples. Okay. I mean, we've elected a black man president twice, right? And you could go down the list of things. Now, again, so to me, if for people that think that race is this enormous, enormous problem in this country, I would tell you it is a problem. Okay, but if you were a little bit older, you would see that the problem is trending, right, on all sides, right, in the appropriate direction. And then if you look at the data from the police shootings, those numbers are less than 10 of unarmed people. And it's gone down. It's down 56% in the last 5 years. And yet the narrative is that there's this genocide going on. And because of this cancel culture thing, we have leaders that won't stand up and say this. Everybody needs to take a breath. We need to come to the table, right? The police unions, right? Civil rights activists, educators, right? Politicians, and whoever else we think should be at the table. And we need to have an adult discussion based on the truth. Right. And in order for us to do that, everybody's got to take a deep breath. Nobody will say that even because of this cancel culture thing. They'll come after you next.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. But and this kind of speaks to my overarching feeling about all this is that I feel like there are two distinct ways that you can move forward. When you feel as though you've identified something about our society that's wrong. Right. When you want to improve something about our society, there are two approaches that you can take. You can take a constructive or a destructive approach. Now, I understand that a lot of people leaned into a destructive approach either because they felt as though they hadn't been listened to, or I think other people just saw an opportunity. The destruction was their actual goal and they saw an opportunity to leverage, right? Now, in order for our society to get further along, to do better, one of the concerns that I have is that, you know, people are genuinely concerned about race in this country, but the dialogue about it is being dominated by things like tearing down statues or being dominated by, you know, personally, I don't really care too much about a statue. I've never learned a thing from a statue. I think a lot of people don't know much about the statues in their communities on both sides. They have to Google it to find out what statues might be in their town and then decide how mad they are about it. I think a lot of the people that are going and defending statues maybe weren't that interested or didn't care that much about that statue a week prior either. To me, I'm not that worried about the statue debate because I know well that we could leave all the statues up or tear all the statues down. And 2 weeks after that, nothing else would be different. And if you want things to be different, if your goal is to manifest change, the only way to do that is through dialogue in this country. yes, you can absolutely take over a country by force and then force its populace to adopt your set of ideals or your set of customs. But that doesn't work in America. We don't swing that way, right? So if you want things to improve, if you would like something to change, the way that you do that is through discourse and dialogue. And you can't do that. And I mean this from either side of the fence. For those who feel as though these statues being torn down is a travesty, for those who feel as though they're kind of being steamrolled into something that they're not, just as much as for those who feel as though they're oppressed and they're not being listened to, the way that you make anything better for your side and for the country as a whole is through an honest discussion. It isn't through forcing your perspective on others, because when you do that, people fortify their positions. When you attack someone, even if they might not have held their position that deeply within them, even if their position was based on a loose opinion that they probably could have changed their mind on, the minute that you attack them, especially with an ad hominem attack, the minute that you say, well, you're a racist because, or you're a SJW because, the minute that we make
it
about that.
What's an SJW?
An SJW is a social justice warrior. It's something that people that lean right, people like me, tend to call people who we feel are going way overboard when it comes to things like cancel culture. An SJW would be the type of person who would cancel you over your 10-year-old tweet, right? Now, it's important to note that just like middle-aged ladies hate being called Karen, people who are very progressive hate being called an SJW, and that's why it exists, right? But the minute that you call someone that, or the minute that you accuse someone of being racist, you're no longer having a dialogue. Now you're having a fight. And when people fight, they'll defend their positions even if they think they're wrong, because they're being attacked, right? So the problem with cancel culture, to kind of circle back around, in my opinion, is that we're using cancel culture as a weapon against ourselves. And when we're using weapons against ourselves, there's no winner in this fight. You know, America is one tribe unto itself. It's become so big, certainly, that it's hard for most people to really feel as though they identify specifically with America, right? So now people are identifying with subgroups. And when you identify with a group, one of the strongest motivators for that is the fear or the disgust with the other, whether it's another group within your own country or, during more nationalistic times, another country that's a threat to your country, right? When we start to see America as separate tribes that are competing against one another, when we start to operate as though the only way we can save America is if our government is all Democrats or our government is all Republicans, because the opposing views are just so poisonous to us. When we approach things like that, that's dishonest. We're not actually trying to make things better. If you genuinely believe that a government comprised of people who only think like you is the best way to make sure that we have a real representation in our government, then I think that you're lying to yourself, you know? And so cancel culture,
well,
the real threat.
Do you find that that's one of the scarier parts of all this is, like,
I do. Genuinely.
Do you not understand the basis of our government, which is vigorous debate? You know, the majority rules, but that minority does have rights. They do have a seat at the table, which is what has made this, you know, this experiment so different from every other one that has populated the planet. Do you not understand that? Do you not understand that our history is filled with flawed people? And then, he who is, you know, without sin, let you cast the first stone. Right? I mean, to me, the lack of critical thinking, and when you see this, because if you look at Black Lives Matter as a logical syllogism, right, then you would say, okay, police reform, certainly. But that's a quick one, right? The next questions that, because Black Lives Matter, then this, then this, then this, are hugely difficult and are going to require, in my opinion, certainly a different approach, certainly, you know, I think.
And and it's got to be a long term. It has to be a long process.
And it cannot be the same shit, because if you look up poverty numbers, right, if you look up the percentage of black and Hispanic girls that get pregnant, right, are multiples of white and Asian girls. Okay. And we all, everybody knows that when you have a child before you're 20, for the average person, it takes away choices, and it keeps you in this cycle of poverty, right? If you look at, you know, teen pregnancy, if you look at gun violence, if you look at these other things that are huge problems, they are, in my opinion, just look at the numbers. And if you rack and stack the numbers, right, black on black violence, teen pregnancy, you know, lack of educational opportunity, the inability to read at a fourth grade level, right, in the fourth grade is horrible. But those are much more substantial problems than, in my opinion, the police. All right. And so if Black Lives Matter, then we get through the police thing, and then the next thing requires a national effort to make the American dream, as Dr. King, you know, his vision was, to be accessible to everybody, right? To be accessible to everybody. And
an important thing I don't know.
Here, let me ask you a question, and then you can have the floor. Where do you see cancel culture going in all of this?
Well, I genuinely hope it's going to go away, at least to a certain extent. And I think my generation is among the first that we're going to have to learn how to forgive people for their missteps on social media, for their mistakes in their private relationships. We're going to have to learn how, because, you know, I'm 35, right? And so that means that it's entirely feasible, especially the way American politics are looking now, that 40 years from now, it will still be people from my specific age group and demographic that are running for president. Right? So we're looking at four decades of people from my age group and potentially slightly younger running for president ahead of us here, right? Now, people of my age group specifically have been on the internet since we were kids, not like today's generation. But, you know, when I was 12, the internet was pretty expensive and I had a 1 hour a week allowance that I was able to go on, you know? I was an early adopter on MySpace. I joined Facebook when I first joined the Marine Corps, and Facebook was only for college students, you know. And my generation was there for the onset of the internet, and we were posting dumb shit from day one, right? So if you need to be, let's say if America isn't that keen on electing a president under the age of 40. So if we assume that 5 years from now, someone my age runs for president and then does every 4 years for the rest of my anticipated life, it isn't possible that we're going to find that many candidates in that age group who have never said a dumb thing on Facebook or Twitter or in a locker room or in an office. I'm not saying that that makes saying dumb things okay. I'm not saying that it makes being misogynist.
But it's part of life. Racist. I mean, okay. It's part of
but
life.
But being an idiot and learning to stop is part of life. I wanted to go back to what you were saying about basically division in our country, because I personally feel as though division is one of our founding principles.
Right.
Us being willing to argue with each other, us always feeling the need to argue with each other, is where we have derived a great deal of our strength. And I had genuinely the most successful Facebook post of my career on July 4th, because I posted a picture of a stone, you know, a headstone that's in Massachusetts that says, by signing this Declaration of Independence, the 56 Americans pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. It was no idle pledge. 9 of the signers died of their wounds during the Revolutionary War. 5 were captured or imprisoned. Wives and children were killed, jailed, mistreated, or left poor. 12 signers' houses were burned to the ground. 17 lost everything they owned. No signer defected. Their honor, like their nation, remained intact. And the reason why I shared that with a message is because it's important for us to understand that those 56 guys, right? Now, they were pretty brave dudes, because now in hindsight we go, of course they were right. Of course they were doing the right thing. Of course they were destined to succeed. But that's not true. You know, they were guys that didn't agree with one another on much stuff. So much so that the only way we were able to ratify the Constitution, which it's important to note, the Constitution didn't come for a decade and a half after our country was founded, right? So our country ran under the Articles of Confederation at first, which effectively treated it as though every state was its own nation. Uh-huh. And then 16 years later, we passed the Constitution, but we couldn't agree on what went in the Constitution, so much so that we passed the Bill of Rights immediately thereafter because it was the compromise that was forced by our inability be unanimous.
But again, another 70 years, 70 odd years later, we fight a civil war because the question still wasn't settled in the minds of a lot of people.
Nailed it, right?
Right.
And so do you mind if I just read to you what I posted?
No.
So I wrote, winning America's independence was not a foregone conclusion. And even as our nation first came to be, its populace was not at all unanimous in its support even for the revolutionary effort. Division has been present since the very inception of this nation. It has informed every major decision our country has ever made in the 244 years since its birth. It's in that inherent struggle that America has found strength, change, progress, and the delicate balance that is our constant fight between both tyranny and anarchy. America is made up of people, and like all things human, it's flawed. Our strength has never come from perfection. It has always come from America's willingness to hurt, our willingness to sacrifice, to change, and to improve. There's no finish line in our race toward a more perfect union. There's only work, effort, compromise, and the promise to ourselves and to one another that we will shoulder our share of the weight of the burden of progress. America is not its flaws. America is our drive to confront and to overcome them. America is our promise to the future that the nation we leave behind will be better, stronger than the one we inherited. This great experiment in democracy is never done. And just as it was true in 1776, it's true today. Victory is not a foregone conclusion. Like the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence, we've got to earn it. America, like its people, has always been flawed. What makes America great is that we were never willing to accept that. It's in that struggle, it's in our fight for improvement, that we find our nation's true strength. And I think that it's important, you know, that's the end of that, but I think it's important for us to remember that there was never a golden age of America without dialogue, of America without rabid, angry fighting in the streets. That is a part of who we are. The difference between America and other nations that maybe were consumed by those demons has always been that America's willing to work on it. America's willing to work on whatever we need to work on to make things better for the American people. Sometimes we fail at it. Sometimes we fall on our face. Lots of times we do a really good job. You know, the standard of living that we have in the United States today is better than you'll find in most nations in the world and is significantly better than you'll find anywhere in the historical record. That's a testament to how good we are at making things better for ourselves. But to circle this back to what you and I are talking about, the only way that dialogue between the two groups, that discourse, our division works in our favor is if we're actually listening to each other. And that's the thing I worry that we're not doing today, is today, you know, people kind of choose their social spheres. They use it as an echo chamber to solidify their views and their positions. And then the people that are outside of those spheres, we see as the enemy. I genuinely, like, I don't care if you're a Democrat or a Republican or a crazy SJW who's going to call me a fascist or a crazy right-wing guy who's going to call me a cuck. If you really care about making this country better, I've got something to talk about with you. You know, we've got more in common than we do separating us. But I worry that we've forgotten that at this point. And I hope to answer your question about cancel culture, I hope that cancel culture is one of the things that dies as we realize that we're going to have to work together to make things better. Because there's no such thing as a just Republican or just Democrat America. You know, we're never going to get there. We need to make sure that we can have an America that both people, both groups are comfortable living in. And I worry that we're further from that every day. But I hope that we get better.
Well, you know, I think we're relearning, you know, lessons firsthand that have not been a part of our life. One of the lessons was why you have a savings account.
Yeah.
Right. And you and I talked about this, but our grandparents were, I mean, they were hell on that. You know, and then, you know, you'd get your job and your grandparents would say, no, you're saving your money. You're like, oh, grandma, I've got a credit card. I got a credit card. I'm good. And now I think we all learn. I mean, think about this. What we're going through now financially went on for 10 years for our grandparents throughout the Depression, the Dust Bowl, all of that happened in our country. I mean, think about that. I mean, they were scarred, you know, by the fear of being caught in this place again. I think the same relearning lessons that we haven't, haven't had to live firsthand is happening now with the whole generation of people. And for me, it got my attention within the last 2 or 3 years, certainly since the time I've been on All Marine Radio and have known you, Alex. And that is, you know, when I can't remember who it was, it might have been Ben Shapiro went to Berkeley to speak or attempted, and there was riots there, and they looted and destroyed stores, and ultimately his speaking engagement was canceled, and then they did it again. And I'm like, what is that? Since Berkeley used to be a bastion of radical ideas and free speech. Now it doesn't believe in free speech anymore. So the universities of this country don't believe in a vibrant exchange of information. And so I guess the next part of this is, to me, you know, what's enabling a lot of this is the universities in this. I see these things on these pieces on TV, and it talks about social justice warriors, where they learn these skills, you know, and that the American university system is breeding this intolerance for anything but what goes on in their echo chamber. You have any thoughts on that?
I've definitely heard this plenty of times before. And to be honest with you, I wrote an article once about a specific school in Massachusetts that I felt as though was particularly guilty of this. It's one of those things that's tough for me because, you know, I went to college. I went to both undergrad and grad school post Marine Corps, right? And I went to school undergrad in Massachusetts right near Boston, which is obviously Boston is a fairly conservative city, but right. Massachusetts is a pretty liberal place, you know, and going to a liberal arts college in Massachusetts is a really liberal place.
Right.
And I think that there's some real truth to that, but my experiences didn't really necessarily confirm it. And I definitely did have professors that were definitely further left leaning and more open, more overt about their politics than I think maybe was appropriate in an educational setting. I will also say though that, you know, because I went to school kind of with that perspective, with the idea that I consider myself to be fairly socially liberal but conservative kind of in my bones. And because I kind of see socially liberal as similar to old school conservatism, which is just leave me alone, right? And so I went into the school environment kind of expecting my personal beliefs to run counter to those that I was going to be kind of exposed to from the teachers. And I did see some of that. But I also want to say, and maybe this is a credit to Framingham State specifically because of their staff. But in the instances where I felt that was the case, you know, I tried my best to always exhibit respect to the professors. So I certainly wasn't going to, you know, yell at them in the middle of class like you might see some people do nowadays. But there were certainly times where I raised my hand and I said that I didn't feel as though that was accurate and my experiences didn't speak to what you were saying about America. And I also at one point specifically took issue with some of the required reading that was assigned to us that effectively contended that the Americans that are dying in the global war on terror have it coming to them because it's not our war to be involved in and we should just be leaving them alone. And I got really angry about the assignment and I emailed my professor and I said, you know, with all due respect to you and your course, I wanted you to know that I'm withdrawing And I wanted you to know it was because of this assignment. And I feel as though it's disrespectful to me and to the friends I have that have served and to the people who have fought and died for this country. And I was really angry. And the professor, instead of going, all right, man, get lost, instead asked me if I'd come in and speak to him. So I went into his office hours. And he took that required reading off of his syllabus for the rest of his classes and asked me if I'd come back for one more class. I did. He didn't call me out or anything, but he just led the lecture in that class about how maybe that last bit of reading wasn't the right thing for him to be giving us. And maybe, you know, the vantage point that he's giving us is specifically his own. And I really respected that. I really respected that he was willing.
That's a great example, Alex, of articulate discourse and what is supposed to happen there, right? But
it doesn't always.
Yeah, and the scary part about this is in I think in my outward observation, if you attempt – and then what was interesting about the Berkeley thing was there was a poll taken and said, do you think you have the right to prohibit somebody whose opinion you don't like from speaking? The answer was yes. I have,
and I take issue with that too. But
if that's coming through in a poll that we have the right to take, to me, it's this whole idea of critical thinking, right? The history of our country, why we are so unique, you know, that's the scary part of it for me. It's like, I don't think you understand what this country is. I don't think you understand the way this country got to be where it is.
Thought isn't good for anybody.
And look, all you have to do is look at the Taliban. Go look at Mao in China. Go look at I'll tell you what, Nazi Germany did the same thing. And what it is? It's mobs. It's totalitarianism. As you've been beating. It's this lack of vibrant intellectual discourse, right, that evolves the product. And so, give me a 60-second answer. Where does this go in – I'll give you 120 seconds. Give me – where does this go in the short and midterm, and then where does this go in the long term, the cancel culture?
All right. In 120 seconds, I'll give you both possibilities. Okay. The one that I think might be true, and I genuinely hope I'm wrong, my pessimism says that where this goes is just continually down in a downward slope because we're living the fall of Rome. I hope I'm wrong, though. The other way that this could go is that we could kind of collectively recognize that there's a difference between being an asshole and a villain. And we're allowed to not like assholes. But we shouldn't vilify them. And just because you don't agree with somebody doesn't make them a villain. It may well make them an asshole. We have to learn to accept that a certain sect of our population are going to be assholes. And we have to try to get better despite the people in both groups that are just – that aren't working to make anything better. You know, how can things get better? We learn to forgive each other and we start to recognize that we're in this together. How can things get worse is we refuse to forgive each other refuse to recognize that we're in this together.
Do you think relative to the long term of this, do you think there's going to come a point where guys like I don't know, you could pick, you know, Bill de Blasio, Gavin Newsom, Andrew Cuomo. I mean, you could – These politicians that we see on our TV, when they stand up and look at the cameras and say, this cancel culture has to end, because they don't say shit about it, because in my opinion
– because it benefits them.
It benefits them. Or even if it doesn't benefit you, you know, people tend not to take it on head on. Do you think there will come a day when moderate candidates, and I would say all those, well, de Blasio might not, but Newsom tries to disguise himself as one. Cuomo tries to disguise himself as one. Do you think when those kind of mainstream candidates from both parties will stand up and say this has to stop? Or do you think,
I don't think it'll happen until there are people my age or younger in those positions. I think it could be my age in 10 years, so 45. I think that a lot of people, a lot of the old guard of politicians still kind of believe that they're insulated from cancel culture because, well, there wasn't an internet in the 80s when I was saying my dumb shit, you know? Right. And as people in my age group who came into adulthood in conjunction with or after the rise of the internet, we're going to have to be able to say, yeah, man, not everything I said in my entire life is my current political position. We're going to have to be able to say, yeah, like, you know, when I was a 17-year-old kid on a Boy Scout trip, I was rude to a woman once and I regret it to this day. I shouldn't have acted that way. We're going to have to be able to say, yeah, man, you know, I said something really stupid once 25 years ago and it's not who I am. We're going to have to be able to say that, because even though
think about how pathetic that is, that I have to begin this discussion with disavowing a tweet I made, you know,
in 1999, you know?
Right. Really?
We're eventually going to have to start grading people on their work instead of their history. And I'm not saying that everybody gets a free pass. I'm not saying that you can be a Klan member for 30 years and then run for mayor of New York City and we should forget about it. But I am saying that we're going to have to acknowledge that people are human, and humans grow inherently as they get older. And
they're capable of change.
Yeah. And that if you were 22 and a hardcore Democrat, that doesn't mean you can't be 50 and a good Republican. And if you were 22 and a hardcore Republican, that doesn't mean you can't be 50 and a good Democrat. You know, you don't have to have it all figured out every step of the way. I firmly believe that. I don't know how quickly our society is to accept it.
What has to happen?
Everybody's got to have skin in the game.
Skin in the game.
And that's going to happen in the coming decades, as everybody has a social media history and everybody's got stuff in their Google that maybe they wouldn't necessarily want shown to the person interviewing them for their new job. Once everyone has skin in the game, I think that there's a chance that maybe we'll stop being so eager to dig. Because if I'm going to dig something up on you, you'll dig something up on me.
Everybody's screwed.
Once we're all screwed, maybe we can start getting better.
Someplace. That's real funny.
Because I don't have a whole lot of faith in just decency for the sake of decency. I haven't seen much of it.
Well, let me tell you, the system that gives you – in the last two elections, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and Joe Biden, is a broke system. If that's the best, if those are the best solutions for our country, we are in a world of hurt. And so,
it's a perfect indicator of the old axiom that anybody who wants to be president probably shouldn't.
Hey, money and name recognition is what it takes now. It's not. It isn't. You don't have to be a great person with great ideas. It is name recognition and ability to raise money. And if you can do that, we can package you.
The rest doesn't matter.
We can package you. We can rack and stack it for you, and we can make it. We can make it work.
God, that's a troubling.
If you see that as a leadership problem, you know, that we've been dealing with in this country for, the last 20 years, you know, that our political system, the way we fund campaigns, is broken. And that this is simply proof of that. And that because of that, we have leaders, we have political people in power that don't have an iota of leadership in them. And you've seen it on display throughout all of this. Then to expect them to stand up and say, this has got to stop. Right.
Yeah. You're never going to find, and this is one thing that comes to mind every time people applaud an executive order that Donald Trump signs, or people applauded when Barack Obama kind of centralized more power into the executive branch.
Right. Did the same thing.
It's the same thing. Yeah. Never, even if the guy that you voted for is in office, you should never be psyched about seeing him absorb more authority. Because it means the next guy. And in all honesty, in America, we do tend to bounce back and forth every 1 to 2 terms, right?
Right.
So you know for a fact in 1 to 2 terms, the other guy is going to be there, or girl, you know? And if you are not comfortable with Joe Biden having the authority to do this, then you shouldn't applaud Donald Trump doing it. And if you're not comfortable with Donald Trump having the authority to do something, then you shouldn't applaud Barack Obama doing it. you know?
Yeah, but the sad part about what you're saying is what we've learned is that it's okay when my guy does it, but when your guy does the exact same thing, when your girl does the exact same thing, then it's bullshit and I'm outraged.
And, really? And we refuse to ostracize our own assholes in every group, in every social group, whether we're talking Democrats or Republicans, we're talking Black Lives Matter, we're talking whatever group it may be. There are people with good intentions, with the right attitude, that are really trying to make something happen in these groups. And then there are your assholes, right? Every 10% of any group is a bunch of jerks. We don't disown our assholes. When you're a Republican and somebody conservative says something stupid, we'll defend them. When you're a Democrat and somebody liberal says something stupid, we'll defend them. We'll defend Kathy Griffin when she holds up a severed president's head in a magazine cover. We don't disown our idiots. We defend them. And that's terrible for us, you know? So I guess that's my parting shot is, if you guys can all out there just realize that you did and said something stupid once, so give other people a break when it turns out that they did or said something stupid. I think that's the first step towards us doing better.
All right. I want to ask you now kind of a humorous thing. Here in Orange County, on July 4th, because there was no big displays of fireworks at like Disneyland or Anaheim Stadium or Newport Beach or Huntington Beach or San Clemente or Dana Point, there was a carnival of fireworks like I have never heard it since I was in Iraq in 2004.
Around here too.
It was unbelievable. It started at about 9:30-ish and it went on at a crescendo that my dog almost lost his mind. Thank God we shoved Benadryl down his throat and he passed out. But it was amazing. You said you experienced something similar.
Yeah, I live in Cumming, Georgia, and I live on a little peninsula sticking out into Lake Lanier. My house doesn't have any lake frontage, but I live on the peninsula and, you know, maybe a couple hundred yards away from lake frontage. And so I think every house with a dock had like their own professional fireworks set up. I was worried, you know, I was like, oh, it's too bad Reagan's not going to get to see any fireworks this year. I got a broken leg. We're, you know, there aren't any big shows going on. We don't want to drive a long way to see someone we know. And instead it turned out that, yeah, from like 6 p.m. to like 10 p.m., it was the biggest fireworks show I've ever seen in my life. I feel like that's the industry we didn't realize that we should have invested in when all this started.
Well, and just so you know, I don't know that all the fireworks that went off around here were legal. And
by that, yeah.
and let me tell you, it was, and this stuff went on till after midnight. It was amazing. It was amazing. And it's like, and I thought, you know, maybe we should outlaw big fireworks because everybody
gets involved.
Everybody, right? Got their pyromaniac firework thing on at things all over the place. But it was astounding in terms of just the audio volume. I text messaged a couple friends. I'm like, hey man, is it crazy where you are relative to? And I got two messages. Dude, I was just thinking the same thing, man. It sounds like Fallujah 2004 on a crazy night. I mean, it just went on and on and on. All right, what's new at Sandbox? And tell everybody where they find you.
Well, I'm really stoked to say that Sandbox over this past weekend actually surpassed our total 2019 traffic. So we're growing really quickly, and I can't thank you guys enough for clicking, for sharing, for commenting. As silly as it sounds, a little thing like just clicking like on a Facebook post really makes an appreciable difference. It shows us to a few more people every time, you know? And so we've got all kinds of great content coming out this week. We just launched a new site revamp recently that's allowing us to publish a lot more content. So not only will Sandbox News be a great place to find stuff from me and my team of writers, but we officially now have syndication agreements with every major military news outlet out there. We are the mighty Task and Purpose, SoftRep, Military.com, Military Times. So our content is going out on all those channels. But what's great about this especially is that means you can swing by SandboxNews with two X's .com And you can kind of catch up on everything you need in a day, because not only are you going to get, you know, four or five new stories from my team, but you're also going to get four or five curated stories from all the best outlets all around the military web, all in one spot, so that you can stay up to date on what you need to know. You can learn about things that maybe you're a little fuzzy on. And, you know, we've also got plenty of entertainment and pop culture stuff, like good movies to watch for the July 4th weekend. We'll have a review for the Hamilton musical that's streaming on Disney Plus up later today. In case anybody's on the fence about watching it, I highly recommend it. And all kinds of great stuff. Now we're going to be publishing like 10 stories a day moving forward. So,
can't you sing most of these songs in Hamilton?
I can and did sing just about every song. It's been part – the Hamilton soundtrack has been on my workout mix for like 2 years now. So I joked that I had to sit down before my wife broke my other leg because I was jumping around on crutches singing with my daughter. I love the Hamilton musical.
All right. Now, here's what we need you to do is we need you to cut your caloric intake.
I'm drinking a caffeinated Slim Fast as we speak.
Okay, because the last thing we need is a more robust version of you in 2 months.
Well, you know, I've been hitting it pretty hard here for the last few months, and I tweeted I hit 300 for 5 reps on the bench 20 minutes before I broke my leg. So I went from feeling like the toughest guy in the world.
Well, you could still lift though, right? I mean, even with the broken leg, I mean, there'll be a period where you won't be able to for, you know, a week or so. But after that, after the swelling goes down and what?
I took last week off, but I think today is I'm gonna get back in there and lift an upper body.
Not anymore.
You know, but I promise I'll try to keep the diabetes away. I'm trying to stave it off the best I can.
All right. Alex Hollings here on a Tuesday morning. Alex, as always, thanks for the visit, and tell everybody where they find you.
Make sure to check out Sandbox News. That's Sandbox with 2 X's, news.com, to find new stuff every day. You can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/AlexHollingsWriter or on Twitter at AlexHollings52.
There he is, Alex Hollings. More of All Marine Radio coming up next right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network. Cancel culture. Ugh. Right? Yeah, it's brutal. So, again, this experiment in democracy has survived other things like it. And, you know, it will survive this. At some point, the adults in the room, and there'll be different people, will stand up and say enough. This nation is founded on certain principles. And your mobs won't change that. And so we've got to account for the police thing. We've got to be able to look people that espouse the things that Black Lives Matter espouses and say, okay, let's sit down and have a grown-up conversation about it. Let's get after this problem. Let's make the American dream available to everybody, which is Dr. King's dream. That, and that his kids would be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin. All right, let's do that. And I think what you'll find is Americans will support that overwhelmingly. And the nation will go to a better place. But I'll tell you what, it's certainly more difficult with leaders who don't lead and media outlets who don't pursue the truth. So, my thanks to Alex for coming on. He comes from a different generation than I do, so the conversation is always interesting. If you're just tuning in hour one, I get about 4 days, and I didn't even get to all of it either. I mean, I get about 4 days of pent-up energy out of my system. Everything from gardening to how cool my 4th of July. Actually, it's not my 4th of July package. It's my patriotic package, right? Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day, and all the major holidays we have in the country. You know, my flag displays go up. Yeah. So anyway, you'll get to hear about all of that. So don't touch that dial. This program continues momentarily. So hope you're doing good. Hope you had a good 4th of July weekend. And that this week continues to be good. All right. And again, don't be afraid to read and look for informed sources to read. You know, I don't know if the news feed on your phone is that. Right. And I would definitely start with the Wall Street Journal. That's my recommendation. If you want a little bit of sanity, turn your TV off. Right. Turn your TV off and go to sites that are known for quality. And control the environment that you live in. Yeah. Helps your sanity. I know it's helped mine. Yeah. So, on a Tuesday, have a great day. All Marine Radio, over and out.